Inselm ilkom unatikom merħba għal episodju ieħor tal-Fakultà tal-Mozzi fuq Campus 103.7. Il-programm tal-lum, avvolja ser inżommu l-istess format, ser nagħmluh bil-lingwa Ingliża. Dan għaliex il-mislen tiegħi llum huwa l-mużiċist u għallim tal-mużika Deacon Cooper. Deacon, welcome to the program and thank you for accepting our invitation. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So, the subject in discussion today is the history of the jazz double bass, a very, very interesting topic, and I think one that is very rooted in different history. As a member of the string family, I believe that it's useful to point out that the double bass, nowadays a jazz staple, originally depart from the orchestral double bass. An instrument is responsible for providing the low end for the orchestral string section. Likewise, the double bass has nowadays become the low end standard for many jazz formations and many jazz tunes. But I think before we delve into the history of how the jazz double bass became to be so integrated into the world of jazz, I think I would like to hear a little bit about the distinction between the orchestral double bass and the jazz double bass, and how they are used in different methods, especially in playing styles such as the pizzicato, the different pizzicatos, and the different articulations. What do you think are the main differences when it comes to tackling the double bass from an orchestral or a more classical point of view and from a more jazz point of view?
Well, to put it simply, mostly the jazz is plucked and the orchestral double bass is mostly played with the bow. Although you can get bowed solos and you can get bowed playing in jazz, and likewise you can still use pizzicato, you can still pluck the bass in orchestral music. In terms of the playing styles, when you do plucked music in orchestral playing, you use a slightly different technique, which creates a different resonance. That's the style. When you play in jazz, you use slightly more force. You use more of the finger, and that gives you a more rounded tone. That gives it more push. Possibly less resonance, although that's not so true nowadays. It depends. And in terms of the actual playing styles, when you play orchestral music, you obviously have to fit in with the section. You obviously have to play what's in front of you. You do exactly what the music says. When you're playing jazz, you have more freedom in at least one sense, in that frequently you play with chords and you make up your line, but you are sort of restricted because you can only really do what fits with the chord. You can't just do anything unless you're playing something incredibly free. In jazz, you are more likely to play solos where you're accompanied by the rhythm section, and you'll play your own melodic interpretation, and you'll improvise. And improvisation it exists in classical music, but it's not so common. Organists, I think, do it quite a lot, but most instrumentalists don't.
And something that has always really interested me when it comes to the double bass is that I believe it's the same instrument, but it has two very different sides when it comes to playing in orchestra and playing in jazz. Is it the style of the player that determines how the double bass sounds? Because again, as you said, there are different techniques and they produce a different sound. Is it the style of the player, or is it the, you know, the way it is in the music? What makes it sound so different when it comes to orchestral playing and when it comes to jazz playing?
Well, there's probably two distinct differences, although, you know, these can be overemphasized. Firstly, jazz players will tend to have a higher action, which means that the strings are further away from the fingerboard, because that gives a heavier sound and that gives you greater freedom. And if you're using some of the techniques in jazz, you'll tend to want more room to get your fingers underneath the strings. Orchestral players tend not to be amplified, so therefore the aim is to get as clear a acoustic sound for the bass as possible, And they will focus upon the sound that you get from bowing the instrument more than the sound you get from pizzicato. So if you are a jazz player, you will use different strings, you will use different setup, you will use amplification, and all of those contribute towards you getting what you might see as a good, might hear as a good jazz sound. If you're an orchestral player, then you'll want strings that that are better suited to bowing, that give you a much nicer sound, and you're not so worried about whether or not you use a pickup or whether you use any amplification.
And now moving on to the history, after we've distinguished between the two different types of bass, the jazz double bass, we can say it's probably you're going to delve into much more detail than me, but as a general introduction, it emerged in the late 1890s as the rhythmic and the harmonic foundation from various different styles of music, which then evolved into the jazz we know today. And there were early players, I'm sure you mentioned much more than I will, like Steve Brown and Pops Foster with their walking bass, and the instrument eventually became a staple for jazz. Before I pass the floor on to you, I found it really interesting because some early jazz bands, because of the use of brass sections, they would use the tuba originally to reach the low notes, which then became reached by the double bass. And it was only eventually, after some time passed, that the double bass gained popularity, and nowadays we can say took over in the jazz sphere. And to make it even more interesting, which was some interesting fact I found out while doing research, was that the double bass and the tuba, some bands would use the tuba for outdoors and the double bass for indoors. Why would you say it was the double bass and not any other instrument, like the tuba, that became the jazz standard?
Well, it is one short answer is that it's by accident, but a more informed answer is that it was to do with a combination of technological development and people responded to that with their expertise. So, for example, the double bass is not as loud as the tuba, and that was always a big problem. So if you're playing outdoors, you need a lot more volume, and the tuba was better suited. And then secondly, the same problem didn't necessarily apply indoors so much, even though the double bass was still quieter. And what happened in early jazz is that the double bass didn't appear on a lot of the early recordings because the double bass didn't record as well as the tuba. The tuba had a much more rounded tone. It was much more consistent because where they were recorded on wax cylinders, they didn't have the range that we have nowadays. So the double bass didn't appear in the early jazz recordings. It didn't appear in the early jazz playing until a little bit later on. And the main reason that it changed was because the style of music changed. Originally, you started with Dixieland, where bass line would be played on the one and the three of each beat, which means that you could always take a breath between, or you could actually have gaps in it. And then they started playing on every beat, and the poor tubists had nowhere they could take a breath, so they would struggle to keep up in the same way. Whereas the double bass could actually just keep on playing endlessly, so that gave it a slight advantage. It still had the problem of amplification, which, so for about 10 or 20 years, there was still no amplification for double basses, not even in big bands, but they came up with a few cunning workarounds for that. And one workaround was to play slap bass, where you really pull the string very hard back from the fingerboard and let it fly back so that it hits the fingerboard with a almost has like a drum. And then the second solution was to play with two double bass players, or three or four, just like they do in orchestras, in order to increase the sound. Until they actually came over amplification, it still sort of struggled as an instrument, but eventually it found its way once they came up with electronic pickups and everything that we use today.
So, shall we delve a little bit into the chronological order of the history of the double bass, Dickin?
Yeah, sure.
So, let's go. I'll leave it up to you to start us from the very early origins of the double bass, as you wish to direct us into this journey.
Well, the very first double basses were Villoni's, And this was a family of instrument that originated in the 15th century. They normally had five or six strings. They had a slightly different shape to the violin, but they look kind of similar. They're deeper than the violin, so in the sense that their backs are further from the front, you know, they have a much bigger sound box. And the way that they were played was slightly different. It was more likely to use chords and that sort of thing as they went on. And then towards the 17th and 18th centuries, the violin family started getting ascendancy over the violones because they were easier to, they were better made, they were easier to keep up. But most importantly, they projected more, so they could be used in concert halls, they could be used in much larger spaces, and you needed fewer of them in order to fill an orchestra. But the double bass hung on. And what we know as the double bass is descended from the violone family, and there were sort of clues to that in certain design features, such as the fact that it has shoulders which aren't rounded like the cello or the violin. They sort of go straight up in a sort of slant. And also the sort of slightly bigger design. But then some other aspects of the double bass have changed. So, for example, it doesn't have the same sort of holes in the front like the violones did. It has sort of F shapes instead of C shapes. So obviously it's sort of been incorporated into the orchestra and the design has faded, so it's not really a true violone anymore. But it's hung on because they found that they still needed some doubling of the bass line. And the early double bass players used to be given the cello music and they would just play along and generally fill out the easier bits, because at the time the double bass was very difficult to play. You weren't really expected to play all of the very fast, intricate pieces. What you normally did was play a simplified version of it on the fly, so you were immediately sort of improvising a line as you went on. And then as the double bass developed, for some reason that is lost in history, there became this interest in writing concertos for them, and one of the earliest concertos was written by Haydn. But tragically, this concerto has been lost, and we never know. Otherwise, we would actually have a concerto written by a major composer, which we don't have in double basses.
It's very unfortunate.
Yes. So we know it exists, and we know that it was performed, but no one's ever been able to find it. But we still hold out hope, because apparently one of his cello concertos was not found until 1961, so it's still possible that it's out there somewhere. But then there were other composers who wrote double bass concertos, such as Dissersdorf and Sperger and Capuzzi. And these show that there was actually quite an advanced technique in the 18th century. But the main figure that sort of developed the double bass at this time was Dragonetti. Domenico Dragonetti was an Italian double bass player who was one of the first people who introduced a sort of virtuoso technique to the double bass. And he wrote 10 concertos himself, and he went on concert tours, and he, you know, sort of wowed everyone with his amazing double bass playing. But perhaps one of the most significant influences he had was that he was friends with Beethoven. And although the evidence of this is ambiguous, it seems that after Beethoven met Dragonetti, he started writing more complicated, intricate bass lines in his symphonies. And in the third symphony, the double basses finally get their own stave. They get released from just playing the cello line. They get their own line. They get tunes in the fifth symphony. They get an incredibly complicated bit in the sixth symphony. And they get the great theme in the ninth symphony. And after that, the double bass was essentially became its own instrument and wasn't just a sort of stay at the back and double what the cellos did. And this carried on in the 19th century, where Brahms, who wrote very interesting double bass lines, partly because his father was a double bass player, so he actually knew the instrument, which is normally quite clear from the way he wrote. And Strauss, who wrote very complicated double whist lines, and Mahler, who wrote a famous solo in his pieces. So towards the 19th century, the double bassist sort of had arrived. It became its own instrument. It wasn't just a sort of backup choice.
Doubling of the cello, so, yeah. You know, filling in orchestrally.
And to accompany this, double bass also increased in its size. Originally in the 18th century, it only had 3 strings. Then it got an extra string. We're not quite sure when, but towards the beginning of the 19th century, it became more common for them to have an extra string, which was the low E. And then towards the end of the 19th century, it sort of increased again, where composers started wanting it to really double the cellos, which means it has to go down lower again to the C. And that means that you either get a 5-string bass or you get a bass with an extra extension, which allows you to get those extra low notes. The technique sort of developed as a result. So double bass players began to be expected to be able to perform very high notes, very low notes, and pretty much play anything in between. And there was also the influence of Bottesini, who came after Dragonetti, but was possibly even more of a virtuoso. And he's been known as the Paganini of the double bass. And he played pieces which they thought, which until fairly, well, at least until the 20th century, a lot of people found impossible to play except for him. They use harmonics and they go from very low, very high, very quickly. And he wrote several concertos and he was extremely popular. So by the end of the 19th century, we got the double bass pretty much holding its own with its whole solo repertoire. Still nothing by a major composer at this time in that sense. Although Dragonetti did influence Foscini to write a double bass and cello duo, which is still very popular, but there's still no major concerto. And we got to a point where to be a double bass player, you had to undergo rigorous training just like any other instrument. It wasn't something you would just pick up. And then it became used in jazz, which, as I said, was something of an accident, because even today, you know, if you go and study at a conservatory, you end up with a situation where of all the stringed instruments, except possibly the violin, none of them make the transition to jazz. There are jazz cellists, but they're very rare.
Very true. I think the double bass is the only instrument that has its own jazz subcategory, you know, from the string section, definitely, because then guitars and drums, there is definitely. Yes. So I'd love to hear more about this accident.
As we said earlier, the idea was that it was a shift caused by the need to play continuously, and that was the thing which the double bass could do, which the tuba couldn't do. The sound was still difficult to project, but they made the best of it by slapping the bass. And then there was the and then the shift to the big band, where they started off with having 2 players, and then some musicians such as Jimmy Blanton was able to have the strength and the oomph, really, to carry the whole big band by himself. Also, Duke Ellington, so he played for the Duke Ellington Orchestra, and Duke Ellington put him at the front so that he could actually project. So similar to how the double bass became quite prominent in orchestras, in a way, it began to get more prominence in the rhythm sections at the same time. But this was partly to do with the need for projection as well, as it wasn't just because Jimmy Blanton was worth looking at. So after the big band development, we get bebop. Bebop is characterized a little bit more by playing very fast. It's characterized by playing in small groups, normally sort of 3, 4, 5, you know, probably no more than 6 or 7. It's also characterized by a sort of more democratic arrangement between the musicians. in which you don't just have the rhythm section providing the accompaniment for the rest of the band. The rhythm section get their own chance to solos, the drums get the solo, the bass gets the solo, the piano gets the solo. And that means that there was another demand made on bass players at this point, which was that they not only needed to be able to improvise like all the other instruments, and they needed to be able to hold their own. And they couldn't just, walk all the way through the entire entire piece like they could with big band. And so this was again responded to by the musicians involved. So Oscar Pettiford is a very good example of one of the first people who was a bebop player. And he started writing tunes for the double bass. He started playing tunes for the double bass. He started soloing in ways that had development. It wasn't just sort of a way of just walking. Until somewhere around that point, double bass solos used to be where the band would quieten down and the double bass would just walk, just carry on playing the same bass line that they would before, but in with a little bit more flourish, and they would go very high and they'd go round, but it would still be a fairly basic sort of solo. And when it came to Oscar Pettiford, he started playing what we might see as tunes. He started developing the melodies. He started soloing in more of a bebop fashion where you develop themes and you use hooks in the same way. And so he started this sort of bebop revolution in double bass, which was then taken up by players like Paul Chambers and Ray Brown and Charles Mingus. And throughout the 1940s and 1950s, these sort of developed the double bass repertoire further. Paul Chambers did bowed solos. I'm sure other people did bowed solos at this point, but Paul Chambers is a particular favourite of mine in the fact that he can just take up the bow and play very, very good solos. Charles Mingus became a band leader, which was not unheard of before that time, but it was very rare.
To have a bass player as the band leader was not something that you would see every day, especially in this kind of context.
Yes, exactly. And a composer, and he had a... so that, to a certain extent, Charles Mingus's band leading eclipses his ability as a bass player sometimes, but he was also quite an innovative bass player. And then it comes to Scott LaFaro, and Scott LaFaro was a very distinctive bass player. He sort of was one of the biggest revolutions in bass playing in sort of at least 20 years at that time. And rather than just sort of walk and solo, he sort of played counter melodies. He sort of worked with the sort of solo instrumentalists. He played most famously in the Bill Evans Trio, and the idea of that trio was that it would almost be simultaneous improvisation of all three members at the same time, rather than accompaniment solo all the way through. And he had an instrument which was slightly different. It was very easy to get up very high. Not that he needed it, because he was technically very, very proficient. And he advanced the double bass he was possibly one of the most last great innovators in double bass technique, although I'm probably doing a great disservice to people who came after him. But honestly, the effect of his technique and the effect of his style of playing hasn't really been matched since. Unfortunately, he died at a very early age, which is very sad, because if he had achieved that much I think he was 25, by the age of 25, then, I mean, who knows where he would be now. His influence can be heard in people like Niels Henning Ørsted Pedersen, who's a Danish bass player who plays the bass almost like he's playing Charlie Parker saxophone solo. He's incredibly fast, incredibly proficient, and incredibly sort of innovative. But after this point in the 1960s, then improvisation and the way in which you play the bass has pretty much become what it is today. I mean, people have built on what existed, but that is pretty much where jazz bass playing got to, we now rely upon amplification. We now use pickups, which means we don't have to have such a high action anymore. We can play much faster. We can give it a lot more. We can play in different styles, and there's still the expectation to be able to solo for everyone.
So, unfortunately, as much as I hate to do this, I think our time is running out, but I think we can manage to make another episode in the coming week. So, to all our listeners, I think it would be very nice to note that we can do a part two of this episode where Dickin has kindly provided us with some jazz tunes, so we'll be referencing also some tunes to also supplement what we are talking about. And I also definitely do have a couple of very interesting questions. Well, to me, they're very interesting, but I hope to you as well. I have a couple of questions about what goes on in the mind of a double bassist when we're talking about improvisation, when we're talking about the double bass and the electric bass. And I think that should definitely make for an interesting part to this episode, because I'll be honest, I've made quite a few episodes, and this was definitely one of my more favorite ones. And this was a very interesting story. Thanks to you, Dickin. I think we'll meet in the next week episode. Dickin, what do you think?
Yes, that sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.